Ladies and gentlemen, this is the moment we've all been waiting for.
Yo, I got this. Welcome to Matt and Jonah Make a Scene, episode number 5.
It's about time with that, dude. It took like 27 takes to get him to just get one that was at least keepable.
Yeah, you got it, man. It's cool. You got it.
You got it.
He did it. I mean, he was getting really pissed off there for a second.
I was kind of scared. Like, I almost left the room.
Should have been.
Yeah.
Because he was angry. Luckily, he's not in my studio. He's in yours.
I guess that's one of our fears then, as far as our topics for tonight is angry men who do voiceovers.
even though he had great, you know, he has a great resume. He was highly recommended to us. Hey, I wanted to mention real quick. I didn't tell you this. I bought mattandjonah.com.
Oh, you did? Cool. So yeah. Now we're going to have 50 websites that interlink together.
Yeah. So, but I'm curious now. I thought, okay, we simplified it as much as possible. Website is literally mattandjonah.com. Then my first thought was, I bet no one knows how to spell Jonah.
That is true. A lot of people like spell. I'm trying to think that when I go to a restaurant, it's always like Jonah, Jeannie, and Jonah. I'm like,
Jonah.
Who
do you know named Jonah? Person.
I should just see if they can spell it backwards. Honage. I bet they have.
Oh, that's
more luck.
Pretty good.
Oh, when we delivered pizzas, the guy who was the manager, how did he remember? You were like, oh, who's the new hire?
Oh,
what did he say my name was?
He's like, oh, I hired this guy. His name's
Johan.
Johan. Yeah, Johan.
And so I'm you're like, looking Johan. For the yeah, you're looking for this Spanish dude, and then I come creeping up and you're like, I know you. I know.
Yeah, right. I was like, oh, that kid's name's not Johan, it's Jonah. So J-O-N-A-H, he somehow got Johan. Yeah. So he took like J-O as being yo, and then he made the rest of it backwards. Good for him.
Good for him.
I hope he's, you know, doing well off, you know, spelling, but hope he's doing something great right now.
All right, so we asked our listeners their top 5 fears, and the reason why we asked them is Matt found this article about it's like a sixth sense of people sneaking behind you, and when you get that feeling.
Yeah. So pretty much what happened was is I found the article and I could have sworn I emailed it to myself, and I did not. I lost it. So either way, what it was is these researchers developed a machine that they could hook up to you and it could make you have that feeling. And just to be specific on this feeling, it's that feeling you get when you're walking down a dark hallway in your house and out of nowhere, it feels like someone is behind you and you kind of just start running to the bedroom. It like that panic ignites with inside of you and like, you know, adrenaline kind of courses through your arms and legs. You know what I'm talking about.
That feeling is awful because I remember even back to when I mean, we were in a band together and I was an adult living with my parents. And when they would go out of town, I would still be freaked out. Like if I had to get up and go to the bathroom or like get a snack from my bedroom, walking back, like I would have to turn lights on in the hallways as I went from like hallway to hallway just so nothing would jump out at me.
I think I'm just now at 32 getting used to being in the dark. Like I can walk around my house without having that feeling. But my mom's house, even into my like early 20s when I lived there, if everyone was out of town, I was so used to, you know, we had, I grew up with 6 people in the house for a lot of it. And everybody's gone and it's me staying the night in that house. Man, I used to check every closet and underneath every bed before I could go to bed because I was so freaked out that something was in the house. And I'm not that superstitious of a person, so I don't know what I was afraid of, but it's that feeling.
Neither am I, and it's strange because it's not that I'm afraid of the dark. Like when I'm in the bedroom, like I'm not afraid of the dark. It's just like that feeling of being alone in a house. Like, I still get it. When Marissa's out of town and, you know, she takes Owen or whatever and I'm at the house alone, I still get that feeling. Like, when I get up to go pee, I'm, like, looking behind myself, just being like...
Whoa. Yeah, so I wish I had didn't lose the article because maybe we could have found out exactly what that was. So...
That'd be crazy.
You're welcome, everyone.
Yeah, if they could identify it and get rid of that feeling. I guess that wouldn't
be cool.
I guess that wouldn't be such a good thing, because if you're like in a bad part of town and you're walking, I guess that sense is important.
Well, you're right. I think I can see where that can be useful. But a lot of the times it's just there freaking you out for no reason. Like, there is no real danger. It's like an illogical fear.
All right, keeping on the subject of fear, let's go over our top five fears. My fifth one is fear of darkness, but it's not just like darkness in general. Like, I'm not afraid of the dark, but I did have this dream, and this was probably when I was 18, and the dream was complete darkness. That's the whole dream. Like, it just kept going on, and I could hear my thoughts.
Oh, wow.
And it felt like hours were going by, and then the hours felt like days. And then all of a sudden I heard this voice in my head and they're like, it's over. That's like this other creepy voice. And I'm like, what? And I was like, I was trying to talk to it and it would just laugh at me. And it was like, it's over. You're dead. And I was like, oh my gosh. And it was just like, this is it. This is forever.
Wow, that's messed up.
Oh yeah. And it felt like forever. And you know, like in a dream, when you realize it's a dream, you kind of try to force yourself out of it.
Yeah, that doesn't happen to me often, but I get what you're saying.
I couldn't force myself out of it. It was just that.
Oh, so you're like stuck in the darkness.
Yeah, and it was just laughing, like little weird laughs and stuff. Like, this is forever. Just randomly saying that in my dream. And I woke up like in a pool of sweat. I was like, oh my gosh.
I have this one of when I was living in the Bahamas when I was like 15. We went out to this reef that was like a mile out into the ocean. And it was like one of the largest reefs in the world. It was beautiful. But on the other side of the reef, the ocean literally drops down just like, I don't know how far enough. And you can look at the water and it's just like darker. It's like a darker blue. And I remember treading water over that and just with like the vastness of, I don't know, or nothingness below me,
yeah.
That freaked me out. Like, it freaked me out just to have nothing below me. Like, anything could happen. It's almost like floating in space.
I went to the Keys in college with my friend, and he had a boat. So we went camping, like, in the Keys, and then we would go out in the water during the day
and go
fishing or whatever. Yeah, it was an awesome trip.
Would you camp on just, like, random islands?
Just random, yeah, random island, random campgrounds, too.
Okay,
just, like, pitch a tent, and yeah. But we were out in the middle of whatever part of the water. And I was like, hey, I'm going to go out. He like brought snorkeling gear. So I'm like, I'm going to go snorkel. And like, we put like fishing poles out and just like kept them sitting there, you know, trying to catch fish. So I jump out and it was like that. Like, I looked down and you couldn't see anything. And I'm like, this is freaking me out. Cause you don't know how many miles like the ocean goes down.
Oh yeah. It's just infinite.
So then I'm getting like this wussy panic attack and I'm like, I'm getting back in the boat. And my friends,
it's kind of like that feeling that we're talking about.
Knowing your situation. So I'm like jumping back in the boat and he's making fun of me because I was out there for like 10 minutes. And literally 30 seconds later, our lines start going crazy and we start trying to reel them in. And there's just a school of baby hammerheads that we're reeling in. And I'm looking at my friend. I'm like, I'm a wuss. I'm a freaking wuss. Like, I almost got eaten alive by sharks. Like, that's a true that's a true story. That was so
that
creepy.
Should be a fear.
Yeah.
What's your number four?
My number four is being around annoying people. And I guess that's pretty general, but there's so many times where I go to like a dinner party or whatnot, and you're just around people that are just annoying. And you go there and you just want to hang out and shoot the crap and be like, talk about sports or talk about music or talk about whatever. And certain people are just so pretentious and they like serve you this meal that nobody wants to eat, but you feel bad and you eat it. And then there's nowhere to go because you don't want to be rude and like leave the party too soon. But it's it's not like a certain kind of people. It's not like, oh, I like music and I like this and I can't be around certain other people. It's like, I can't be around the pretentious people that are like talking about the latest cause and like the latest politics that go on. And it's just like, get me out of here, because these people have no identity and it's so uncomfortable. And it's kind of, what's the word? You feel like cornered.
Yeah, I know what you mean by the pretentious thing. Like, I've been a, well, I think it's just kind of silly. Like, when people, you know, I'm all for people being better than they are or striving to be better than they are. But there does come a point when they're, you know, whether or not they're doing it for, are they trying to put something on for me? Or are they trying to, you know, just make themselves happy by talking about what they want to talk about?
It's even worse when you're the only like couple that isn't like that. Like, everybody's talking about like some insignificant thing going on in their life the whole time. And it's just like, why am I here? How did I get here? Like, get me
what
out,
if you please. Brought up something insignificant that's going on in your life?
Oh, they would totally just dismiss it. Like, look at me. Like,
oh, really?
Like, five heads. If I brought something like insignificant, like a football score or something, they're like, oh, yeah. And just start talking about like, Joe Biden or something. And it's like,
who's Joe Biden?
Exactly.
Exactly. Aha, take that, pretentious dinner snobs.
You know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
There's times where Marissa, my wife, says, not everybody likes what you like. And I'm very much a product of American culture and appetite. So if people from other countries were visiting and wanted to indulge in the food I made them, or partake in conversation, that's where it would be uncomfortable for them. But as an American, you have like other Americans over, Marissa will make like chicken dip or like sliders, like hamburger sliders and all this other like awesome food that you would expect at a party. And I remember my birthday party a few years ago, she's like, no one's going to eat this. You just got these weird like understanding of what people like. And they came over and it was gone literally in 5 minutes. And I was like, everybody likes this food. That's the thing. If you're going to have a party, why don't you just have food that everybody's going to like? Isn't that the point of a party, so you can get together and just hang out and enjoy each other?
That's a good question.
Yeah. Instead of making everybody miserable.
I always thought the goal of parties was to get wasted.
Oh, that's but even we'll worse see. When you go to a party and they're just like, here's some hot tea. And it's like... Oh, we're in England now. This is cool. Yeah.
No, I need a whiskey. Yeah. The goal is to chug a few beers or, you know, have a cocktail before you go. Kind of loosen up. Like, it's easier that way. Okay, number four. I'm just going to get it out there because I feel like this probably is along the lines of other people's as well. But the idea of war coming to America, like, I very much like the idea of feeling safe. And, you know, sometimes on 4th of July or New Year's, I'll imagine the fireworks going off as bombs, and that would freak me out. And I hate that there are human beings in the world that are subjected to that, you know, for whatever reason, whether or not, you know, it should or should not happen.
I mean, in America, you don't think about it too much because we're not subjected to a draft or some involuntary, like, force of...
Until it's needed.
That's right. I mean, but if you're going to think about war, I totally agree. Because I that's why I would never sign up for the army or any kind of military institution, just because I know I'm a wuss. Like, I couldn't handle it.
I think it's amazing. Like, we have friends that have, you know, did their time in the military. And it's incredible that they're that type of people because they kind of keep people like us safe.
Yeah. And then we can get into politics at a later date, but as far as people on welfare making more money than someone in the army, which is a whole other subject.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. Look it up.
Okay.
It's not like a ranking, like, you know, like a high officer, but someone who signs up for the military, they're making less than the average welfare recipient.
Is the welfare recipient paid based on like a 40-hour work week?
I think so. I'm not sure if it works like as a like unemployment or something.
Okay.
As far as welfare, because I know unemployment, some like one of my jobs up north at an AV company, somehow I didn't get let go, but I went out for a job and then I came back and like a third of the company was missing.
Oh, wow.
And I would keep in touch with those people and they're like, I'm making, you know, $500 a week cash.
That's incredible.
Which isn't like crazy money, but for doing nothing.
Oh, that's pretty good.
That's pretty good. Nothing. Yeah.
Like, I feel if I could get $500 a week cash for that, I could start up like a side business.
Oh, yeah.
And have enough money to, you know, supplement my income.
Yeah. So when I saw that, it was just like this, you know, I didn't really think about it. I knew there was welfare and unemployment, but I didn't know it was like $500 a week for doing nothing. That's crazy.
All right. What's your number three?
My number three is school.
Like high school?
No, I don't know. Like I graduated from Full Sail and then I decided I was going to go back to try to get an accounting degree. And you have to like sit through the gen ed classes. And I did okay in school and I remember like hating it though, like dreading it. Like not like dreading like getting in the car and like the process of getting there. Once I got in the parking lot, everything in my head was telling me to leave. Like it was like a panic attack. And I was like, get me out. So I put up with it for a semester. And then I went back for summer school. And I remember driving in the parking lot and going, I was like, I'm done. Like all the voices in my head are like, get out. And I just drove away and never thought about it again.
It was that easy.
Yeah. I was like, I never had that voice in my head again. So go figure.
See, I hated high school. I didn't go to high school at all. I skipped to play music, essentially, to skateboard and play music. And
you could have played music and skateboarded and gone to school.
Oh, no. I wanted to do those things during the day. Okay, skipping school was like, okay, I would leave school. I remember my first couple times skipping high school, and I'm like, it's daylight out. It's beautiful. Like, how could they try to trap me in that terrible building? It was terrible. Like once I knew the freedom of not being there, I did not want to be there anymore.
That's a wrong feeling though. Once you get that feeling of not being there and actually going through with skipping, it's like, why am I doing this to myself?
Yeah, it's addictive.
Yeah, it is.
So, but when I got to college, man, I didn't like it at first, but when I went back later on, I loved it. I loved it for me, like just being in the class. Like I think I was able to kind of like be there for myself and just be like, this is benefiting me, you know, learning these things. And I took classes that I enjoyed and it was a lot of fun. All right. Am I a number three?
Yep.
Is, losing a limb.
Ooh. Yeah. I didn't even think about that. Yeah. That would be pretty freaky.
And I know I could adapt. Like, I know for a fact that I could. It's just something you'd have to just accept and get over.
What but about something of, as big as, like, your sight? Like, your eyes?
Well, actually, I was going to bring that up
when
you said darkness.
That's like, yeah.
Because we both wear glasses. So yeah. It is a fear of losing my sight. I think I have, like, whenever I lose, if I misplace my glasses for any reason, I start panicking. Like, where are my glasses? I can't see. I'm never going to see again.
Okay, so my number two is failure. And failure is a pretty broad subject, but I only get myself involved in things that I'm truly interested in. For work, I seek jobs that I like to do. And if I get one of those jobs, I get over-prepared for them. So if something goes wrong, it feels like the world's melting. Like, it's like, I did this. It's just endless troubleshooting.
So failure, because, I mean, we all have that to a certain degree until we, you know, just accept it.
Yeah, but it's hard when you're overly prepared for something and it's something you can't control steps in. And it's like, I guess it is a good awakening call as a human being. It's like, you can't control everything. Relax.
Yeah, you can't. You can't. And that's what I worked with a guy that was pretty good at accepting that because I am not. And when something would go wrong, sometimes I just start, you know, my mind would start racing and I'm like, what could have prevented this? To a degree that is a good thing, but I think there is a balance where it becomes a bad thing as well.
And I obsess over it. That's why it's one of my fears.
And I can see that. I'm right there with you. And all right, my number two, eternity. I have such a fear of eternity.
like and eternity, all forms good or of bad, eternity. Or just like,
oh, good or bad. I remember, you know, I grew up in the church, and they're like, oh, you're gonna go to heaven forever, and I'm like, forever? Oh, like, I just don't like the idea of forever. Eternity is too long. It's like something my finite brain cannot grasp.
Oh, I totally agree that concept. But is it like just a part of you would just wish that there was some stopping point?
Oh, yeah. I like the idea of endings. I just do. I think, you know, to say that something could go on forever and that it will go on forever is... that's just scary, because what if at some point I don't want it to go anymore? Maybe it's just me being in control. When you talk about eternity. Too.
But you said you were raised in the church, and I'm a Christian. So when I think about eternity, like when people are say they're afraid of dying, like dying doesn't freak me out, because I have that like comfort. Like I believe in eternity, and I believe in heaven. And I think I'm going to live forever. So you're not like truly dying. The only thing about dying, like human existence, that freaks me out is like dying at a young age and leaving a family behind. Because that's
okay. Yeah.
Oh, that like breaks my heart. Just that thought.
And actually, let's go ahead and let me segue into my number one. Did you do your number two? Because that's so good with my number one.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. My number one is dying instantly. And I know it's probably like the least amount of painful. But it's a fear for me because, like you just said, I don't get to settle any of my, you know, things on earth.
Right.
Like I'm like done. I don't get to be like, oh, I love you or goodbye. You know, that's one of my fears.
Yeah. If you've lived a full life and you know the end's coming, I think it would be a little bit easier to take than you're riding your bike and then you get hit by some
Yeah, absolutely. Because I'm right there with you. I'm not that afraid. I'm not afraid of dying necessarily. When I'm old and laying in a bed and ready to go, you know, like not out of nowhere. Like I don't want some, you know, idiot to just cross lanes and smash into me. Like I don't want that to happen.
That's why I say short little prayers every time I get in the car about driving carefully. And in case I do get like sideswiped or something, like, you know, give me the peace of mind to like deal with the situation. I always do that when I get into a car. So my number one is demons. So I believe in the Bible and I believe in demons, and those freak me out because it's not like they're creeping in the corner and they've got horns and like a pitchfork or whatever. It's more of a mental thing for me. So if you believe in good and evil, the demons will try to take things that are bad and make them appear good. So things you're into, like certain things that are bad, like overeating or smoking cigarettes, it's like, just do it. You deserve it. You know what I mean?
What we talked about, I love to overeat.
Yeah. And in the Christian world, doing those things are just as bad as everything else. So it's such a hard dilemma where they're just trying to trip you up every which way. And that creeps me out.
Okay. So like you said demons, and our buddy Jason told me he had this dream one time about this horned figure peeking through the crack in his door, and he had green glowing eyes.
Speaking of being a kid with demons, I remember watching a 2020 special as a kid.
And
it was about possession. And so I'm in third grade watching this, terrified. And I try to go to sleep at night, and I couldn't sleep. So I'm like screaming for my parents. And my parents are like, being Christians themselves, couldn't be like, that's just make-believe. You know what I mean? They had a very hard time comforting me. In that situation, it's like if Jesus is here too, think about it that way.
Yeah, I could see that being more comforting. He's here too, but the demon's still here.
Yeah.
I used to watch this TV show called Fire by Night, and it was like a teenage, it was when I was probably 8 or 9 years old, but it was like a teenage Christian show. And man, they had all those things, like, and it used to freak me out. Oh,
but it's not like so much like, you're going to hell. It's like they're taking everyday normal events just to trip you up and make you an awful person.
Yeah, you know you're talking like a practical fight between good and evil.
Correct.
Like, okay, yeah, and that makes sense. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read off a few of our listeners' top fives. First, we got Rich, and Rich's top five is making me laugh. It's used Q-tips on the ground.
I don't know if I've ever seen use Q-tips. I like Q-tips to clean out the outer part of my ear, but my wife with Q-tips, she'll go into the ear and just like dig around in there. She's like, oh, it feels so good. I'm like, this is so disgusting and horrible for your ear.
Yeah, I went to the ear doctor recently and they said that is terrible to do because you don't realize how far you're putting it in.
Oh, yeah.
And you can actually go to the ear doctor and they'll clean out any wax in there.
Yeah.
It just like, so you're not supposed to, but use Q-tips on the ground. That's disgusting. Like, does he mean outside or in his own house? Because I'm just thinking it covered in gross, thick, yellow wax. Ugh. All right. Sorry. Okay. Next we have, let me see here. We have Lisa, and her greatest fear is being held in under a blanket. Ooh. So I think what she means is like having like a blanket over her and yeah, like, or like just like being trapped under a blanket, not being able to move.
Yeah. That's pretty creepy.
Yeah. That's creepy. Good job, Lisa. You should be afraid of that. Be afraid.
Be afraid.
And then we have Mike, and his number one fear is, it says President Palin.
Cool. I exactly. I think both political parties, especially the Republicans, are so far past Sarah Palin and the mistake that was that no one should have a fear. People, if there are a conservative platform, if vice versa, since like Sarah Palin's a Republican, people that disagree with Hillary Clinton definitely have her to fear coming up because I think she's probably a shoo-in somehow. Somehow.
Well, it's besides me. And before Sarah Palin's a Republican, she's first just a moron.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw this thing, and I don't know. As far as Hillary Clinton, I'm sure a lot of people are going to be down for that. Me personally, I'm totally this, like, I think we kind of have to end these families.
Family ties,
that,
yeah.
Yeah, that keep getting elected into presidency. Like, that just has to end at some point. Like, you know, there's more people out there than somebody that was related to a former president. Let's move on. You know, not to say they can't perform other jobs, but whatever.
Well, they perform other jobs and then get people murdered and then create a huge cover-up and then people magically forget about it. Okay, we'll get into another subject.
No. Yeah, I didn't follow it. I'd like to catch up on it at some point.
We will. Let's get into politics one episode and just lose everybody.
Yeah, right?
Snooze fest. We'll get so hot and bothered. That sounded gross. Hillary Clinton, hot and bothered.
Getting hot and bothered over Hillary Clinton.
Okay, go over. Keep going on with the list.
Oh, that's all I pulled up.
Okay. Well, now we'd like to welcome Mike Felumley, singer-songwriter of the band The Bigger Empty. He's also the former drummer of such bands as The Smoking Popes, Alkaline Trio, and Squirt Gun. How you doing, Mike?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
I'm good as well. I have to ask, I keep seeing, I'm looking on Facebook and it's freezing all up north, and Joe and I are in Florida. Is it cold there? Are you in Chicago or where are you?
I'm in Chicago. I live in a town called Westmont, which is like a western suburb of Chicago. And it is freezing. I think the wind chill today was like -7 or -9.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Did you ever live in this city when you were up there?
No, I work in the city. I work at the Merchandise Mart in Chicago for Motorola. And it's huge building. I think it's like the second biggest building in the United States to the Pentagon.
Yeah.
I might have to Google that. I could be wrong, but I think it's the second biggest building square footage wise.
I've got friends that live up in the city, and I just remember being up there for the winter and like crossing the bridge and stuff. It was brutal. Like, as far as the windshield, it's unbearable.
It's terrible. Yeah. I take the train to work and I walk about a mile from the train to my office and it's freezing. I actually took a bus today. It was too cold.
Oh, I just looked up the Merchandise Mart. I think when I was in Chicago over the summer, my fiance's brother's family lives up there. And we went on the boat tour, and which is very touristy thing to do, but it was a lot of fun. It's kind of looking at the architecture. And I think we might have passed by that building. It is huge.
Yeah, they do. I see the boat tours going by like every day when I'm outside. Well, not now that it's -9, but during the summer.
Yeah, man, I was so impressed with Chicago. I somehow hadn't been there before this year. And it really, I was there in August, and I was amazed at how the city, like that bike trail along the lake and everything, like, I don't know, it feels like the city really celebrated the summers.
Yeah, we enjoy the summer. It's very short, so I think we all appreciate nice weather because we have so little of it. Especially last year was a brutal winter, and it seems like we're starting out that way again this year.
For our listeners that aren't aware of you, I'm sure they're aware of your work with the Smoking Popes, Alkaline Trio, and like I think you did a brief stint with Squirt Gun too. Is that right?
Yeah, I did a couple of tours for Squirt Gun. I did one in the United States, and then I went to England with them for about 15 shows or so. And then I was supposed to play on some, they were going to record new material that I was going to play on, but that has yet to happen. I mean, it's been, I think I played with them in like 2009.
Okay.
So I don't know. It's, you never know what might happen. They may call me one day and say, we're ready to go. So I still owe them some drum session work. So if they're ever up for it, I'm here.
So you've been doing the solo career for a while now, and I've been keeping up with that too. And I was really surprised because there's a lot of you play drums first and foremost, correct? Is that how you started out?
Yeah, I started as a drummer. I started drumming, I think, when I was about 13 years old, and played in some, you know, just terrible punk bands. One band was called Article One, was the first band I played in. We played a bunch of garage shows, and we actually opened for the Smoking Popes at like a garage or basement show somewhere. And then they played one show as the Popes before I was their drummer, and then that guy disappeared somewhere, and they called me, and that was in about 1990.
They called you. You didn't even seek them out. Like, were you into them watching the show, or did you not like even think about it until they called you?
No. Yeah, I was into them. They were like in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. We had kind of a big like basement and garage show scene. It was really kind of a cool thing. Like Glenn Porter, the original Alkaline Trio drummer.
Yeah.
He and I, we were in the same grade, and we went to junior high and high school together, and we would play like shows in his garage and shows in our friends' basements. And he was in a variety of different bands. I think one was called GAD, Grubby and the Dirtballs. And my band Article One, we would play, and like we would play together like in Glenn's garage, and there'd be like 200 people there.
Wow. Wow.
Just watching. And our bands at the time were pretty terrible. But the Smoking Popes, they started as a band called Speed Stick.
Yeah.
And they just changed the name to Smoking Popes, and like they were kind of quote unquote like a bigger band. Like, you know, our 150 person garage shows, it'd be 250 if they played.
Nice.
So, you know, when they
called me,
which is
still pretty impressive for a small show.
Yeah.
Yeah, like when it's in someone's garage or a basement.
Packed
or
wall to wall, yeah.
We used to do like VFW hall shows in Elgin. And a lot of bands came out of that scene between like the Smoking Popes and then the Slapstick guys, and like Matt Skiba's early bands played in that same scene. So you ended up with, you know, out of that you had like the Smoking Popes and Slapstick, Alkaline Trio, the Lawrence Arms, it kind of ended up coming out of there. The Broadways.
There was just a slew of bands coming out at that time. That's crazy.
Yeah, they're like just that Northwest suburban scene at like early 90s was really big and created a lot of bands that kind of lived on for a long time. It was pretty cool.
Did you recognize that in the moment that you had a pretty, you know, special collection of bands there, or artists?
I don't think we ever did. I think we just all thought that's how it was. Like, and there are probably scenes going on like that right now, but I don't think we really appreciated it at the time. Just because we had shows going like pretty much every weekend. There was a show between like Crystal Lake, Dundee, or Elgin, Illinois. There was like a show going on somewhere, and there were always tons of kids there. I think we just thought that's how it was. Like, this is how shows are.
Yeah.
But it's funny now, you know, you go play like with my solo stuff or with my new band, The Bigger Empty, like we'll play actual venues and, you know, have a fraction of the number of people. I suppose it's because we're old now.
Right.
You know, all of our friends and fans all have kids and jobs.
I wanted to bring up with Smoking Popes, like I was a big fan of the Smoking Popes. And then I remember we're somewhat of the younger generation, even though we're old now. I remember being in high school, like 11th grade, hearing this band called Tuesday, which Dan,
yep,
the bass player from Alkaline Trio, was in. And I remember at the time I was like, I'm not that into it. And then later on, I heard like a couple years after that, Alkaline Trio came out, and I was like, mm-hmm, yeah, it's okay. It kind of sounds like the Smoking Popes. And then a year after that, I think it was Spin Magazine or something, I actually did sit down and listen to the first two Alkaline Trio records. I'm like, this is really good. I mean, this is like a grittier Smoking Popes. And then I saw a picture of you with the band, and I was familiar with the Smoking Popes. And I'm like, how, from an outsider looking in, I was like, how ironic. A band that sounds somewhat like the Smoking Popes has the drummer of the band from Smoking Popes. So now that you're telling these backstories, it makes kind of more sense that you guys were all friends. But as an outsider looking in, you're like, this is weird. Like, did they just like call up? Like, we kind of sound like the Smoking Popes. Let's go. Just give them a shot. Call them up.
Yeah, like we had all played shows together in different bands. And one of the early Alkaline Trio shows, they opened up for the Smoking Popes at, I think, the Double Door in Chicago.
Okay.
So we had played together, and, you know, I wasn't real close with Matt and Dan, but I just knew them kind of through the scene. And they just,
yeah,
called me one night out of the blue when they lost their original drummer, Glenn. They had a tour book they had just released. Maybe I'll Catch Fire had just come out.
Uh-huh.
And they had a tour booked, and they said, you know, you want to come drum with us? And I said, sure.
That's crazy.
So,
which is pretty cool to be a drummer, you know, because drummers are always sought after, but it's pretty neat that, you know, you grew up in the kind of, I guess we'll call it a scene with those guys, that you were available, you know, to play in some pretty awesome bands. And that says something about, you know, your talent and availability as well.
Yeah, I think there's some luck. You know, I've been lucky to play with some really good songwriters over the years. You know, I was always a big fan of Josh from the Popes. I was a big fan of his songwriting. And then I liked Matt and Dan's songs a lot. So I think I got really lucky on that level too. Because as the drummer, you can kind of influence the direction that the songs go, but I wasn't the primary songwriter in either one of those bands, so I was just lucky to,
sure,
play with some really talented writers.
Well, was that somewhat surreal? Because, like I said, from an outsider looking in, as pathetic as this sounds, I got into you guys from, as well as I did a bunch of other bands, but I remember watching 120 Minutes being in like 7th grade late at night, and I remember seeing the video for Need You Around. And that's how I got into, mm-hmm, you guys. So I went out and like tried to look for everything that you guys put out. Was that a bit surreal though, as far as the signing process, or was it kind of like out of nowhere as far as like Capitol calling you guys, or did you have like a feel that labels were, you know, showing interest?
It was surreal. Like initially, I think the most surreal thing like off the bat was, we were, you know, a local band. We had done a couple national tours, and we were on a little label called Johann's Face Records.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
And we started the song Need You Around. There was the radio station Q101 in Chicago, which was one of the big commercial rock stations at the time. They started playing the song like on their local showcase on Sundays. And then we had a pretty big following in Chicago just from all the shows that we had played here. And people started calling and requesting the song during the week. So it ended up, cool. Like before we had any label interest or anything, like Q101 started playing our song like 30 times a week on the radio.
Wow.
Oh my God.
And then once that happened, I think we were initially contacted by, I can't remember the guys' names. They were the guys that managed Green Day at the time.
Okay.
And they got in touch with us and they wanted to manage the band. We didn't end up going with them, but they set up like a show. We opened for Green Day at the Vic Theater, I think in 94 in Chicago. And there were some people from the labels there. And so it was pretty much all because of the airplay on Q101 that and they were, I think, the second biggest radio station in the country at that time, that then all the industry folks started coming around. And then we ended up having Joe Shanahan. He owns the Metro in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up managing the band and kind of guiding us through talking to all the different labels. And that was a really fun, surreal experience that, again, I think due to our age and not knowing any different, we didn't probably appreciate the way that I would now.
Yeah.
Because we were just kids and
right.
You know, they're flying us out to Los Angeles and we're staying at hotels and everything's comped. We'd be emptying out the mini bars and
everything.
It was pre-cell phones, so we'd get, call long distance to your girlfriend from Los Angeles for 2 hours and have Capitol Records pay for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing when you think about it.
Well, I remember listening to Born to Quit, and then you guys put out Destination Failure, and I listened to that, and then at first listen, I was like, I don't know, because I'm a huge sucker for pop format, verse, chorus, bridge. And then after the second listen, I was like, oh my gosh, this is brilliant. That album blew me away. Was it intentional that you guys kind of tried to change up the songwriting formats?
Well, that would be... I know we really, we just wanted to make an awesome record, and we had, I think we demoed probably 30 or 40 songs for that one and then kind of pared it down. It was originally going to be fewer songs than what it ended up with. Cause we ended up I Know You Love Me. It was actually added to the record later. We had the whole record kind of tracked and done. And then we added that song and a couple other ones after we were finished.
Were they trying to push for a single?
Yeah, that's pretty much we had the record done and the label said, there's not a hit here. There's not a single. So Josh went back and wrote some more songs. And that's how Let's Hear It for Love. That
yeah, because you guys put that on. Yeah, your first CD or your first album.
Yeah, and the Capitol people really liked that song, and we had been playing it live. The way it is on Destination Failure is how we had been playing the song live for a year or two prior to that. So, and the same with Can't Find It, that was also from Get Fired. We felt the way we were playing them at that time, it was different enough that it's almost a new song, so we added those two.
Yeah, the drum sounds on that album are beautiful. I love the drum sounds on Destination Failure. How much of an impact did Jerry Finn have on that? Because I noticed, as far as an outsider looking in, because a lot of people that listen to music aren't geeks like myself, where they'll look at the engineer or the mixer who did it. And I noticed, Jerry Finn mixed Destination Failure, and he also mixed From Here to Infirmary. And you can totally tell. The drums are just in your face, really polished, really smooth.
Yeah, I think it's funny because I hadn't listened to that record in forever, and I just listened to the song Pretty Pathetic the other day, maybe 5 days ago, and I thought, wow, this drum sound is pretty kick-ass.
Oh, yeah.
But I think in a lot of ways, Phil Bonet, who we did Born to Quit with,
yeah,
He was the engineer on most of Destination Failure, and he was from Hoffman Estates. They had a studio called Solid Sound in Hoffman Estates, and he was like our guy. And the funny thing going into the recording of Destination Failure, as a drummer, I was a little bit concerned because at the time, when bands signed to major labels during that period, usually their drummers would get fired when they would go into the studio.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Just like Soul Asylum had just made a record where they fired their drummer and got the guy from Duran Duran. there were like a slew of bands that all got in the studio and like their drummers get fired and they bring in like some like pro guy from LA. So yeah. I worked with, and I was still a young kid, and if you listen to like our early 7 inches, you know, I didn't know that a song was supposed to start and finish at the same tempo and things like that.
Oh yeah. So on Destination Failure, did they work hardcore with like click tracks and stuff, or was it pretty organic?
That was the first album I ever played to a click, and we did demos of everything with Phil beforehand. And like, I had a couple just long, like Phil and I were pretty close, and I had a couple of times just hanging out at the studio with Phil, just kind of talking about like, what do I need to do so I don't get fired?
Which is a terrible thing to do.
Yeah, it's a terrible.
Yeah, you're at the height of, you know, this is pretty exciting time, and here you are having to worry, which is natural, I suppose, to worry like that on some level.
Because I never played on like a big, like, Born to Quit, we spent like $900 on that record total.
Wow, really? That
and
was
we
it?
Recorded it.
Oh, wow.
Because that album sonically still sounds, it still holds up.
Yeah, I think it sounds really good. Yeah. And we would do, like, what we would do with that is we recorded it in like 2-song chunks because we didn't have much money. So we go play a couple shows, sell some merch, go into the studio, record 2 songs, and then repeat that process until we had a record.
Oh, that's
great. And then Phil would always, you know, we'd pay him for 5 hours and we'd work a 10-hour session just because he was awesome.
Yeah.
So, but that's like, cool. He was a really big mentor to me kind of in the early stuff. I was just real spastic and trying to just do whatever I could do. But he was a big mentor to me actually becoming more of like a musical drummer and just like steady and solid. Like he kind of coached me up. And so I think without Phil, I probably would have still been like a spastic freak on the drums and would have probably been fired by the producer.
Yeah, sometimes it's not wrong to sit in the pocket.
Yeah, I mean, if you listen to those early 7 inches, it's like every other measure I'm doing like a 2-measure-long drum fill.
At what point did you want to start creating your own, you know, music where you started singing? You said in the late 90s, but what kind of made that transition from just playing drums to wanting to do that?
I'm not sure the exact reason. I've always been really into recording. Like, okay. You know, back in the days, I used to record, like, Josh and I would demo all of the Pope stuff on a little 4-track that I had.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I was always just kind of obsessed with getting like better sounds on my cassette 4-track. And I probably should dig up the tapes. There's a lot of songs that, because Josh lived at my parents' house with me for about a year and a half. And so we'd be sitting around, like if we weren't on tour or something, we'd be sitting around the house and I'd be like, I'm bored, let's record a song. And he'd be like, okay. And then he would go upstairs. He'd go upstairs to the room where he was staying, and like an hour and a half later, he'd come down and be like, I've got one. So then I'd learn it, then we'd record a song, and that's what we would do with our day.
That's crazy. But yeah,
they're probably like 100 songs worth of that stuff. And then I think I started writing songs because I just wanted more shit to record.
Okay.
Like, you know, Josh isn't always around, so I'm going to just write it.
So after that, like I kept up with your solo stuff, and then you released, I think it was a split with another band, but there's a song called From Where You Are. And when I heard that, that song stuck in my head. It still does. Matt and I, were driving around the other day, and I put that on, and it was just like, gosh, that song's so good. I was like, this guy can write a pop song. Like, the hooks are super soaring.
Let's be specific. We were driving around listening to that song. We were driving around because Jonah's son hadn't taken a nap. So we're just driving randomly around and trying to get him to fall asleep while blasting that that split. But yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. That's one of my favorite tunes that I've written too. I always kind of wish that I thought like that one should have been a bigger song.
Yeah, the hook on that is incredible.
Yeah, that it's right when Jonah brought it up, it just came right back into my head. So, and I think that's a good sign.
For a while, you were put in, I think it was on Bandcamp, you were putting out singles that were like done with a drum machine or something. Like, it sounded like a drum machine, yes. But the songs were so good. There was a song called Friday Night Lights that you did. And I was, as nerdy as that sounds, I was a huge fan of the show. But that song, the chorus is super hooky too. I'm just listening to these songs. I'm like, what is this guy doing? Like, in his basement, like like crafting these pop gems. Like, what is going on? Like, why?
Yeah, a lot of those, because I lived in a townhouse, so I couldn't have like a drum set to mic up. So I would actually play I'd play V drums.
Yeah.
And then use samples. Like a lot of them I use the Steven Slate.
Yeah, I use the same exact samples. Yeah, I've got a little MIDI keyboard that I use and quantize to death because I'm awful at that. But go on, sorry.
Yeah, I would do the keyboard method, and I thought, well, this is ridiculous. It takes me 3 hours to make a drum track I could play in 3 minutes. So then I bought some V drums. Most of those are like me playing, but I'm playing V drums, not real drums.
Yeah,
but I'm considering, like, the Friday Night Lights tune is not on the Bigger Empty record, but I kind of want to record it with the band and maybe put it on our single because I like the song too.
So with the Bigger Empty, besides like the full length, you guys, have you been playing shows? I think I saw a flyer on Facebook that you put out. How's that going?
Yeah, we played a couple. It's going good. We're having a lot of fun playing. We don't get like very big crowds at this point, but we're having fun, and that's really kind of the main goal with this band. Is just, it's four guys that just we like to rock together. So we all, you know, all of us have jobs that pay our bills, and we're not counting on the band to do that, so we're just doing it kind of for the love of making rock music.
It's
we
nice
have a couple shows coming up.
Yeah, that's a great place to be, like, where you're just like together playing music because you enjoy playing music, and there's no, you know, not too much weighing on that other than just enjoyment.
Yeah, and you kind of have,
yeah.
It's almost like you do it because you have to, but there's no financial expectation to follow that, which is nice as well, because you mentioned that you have, like, everybody in the band has jobs as well.
Yeah, like, my financial expectation for the Bigger Empty is for me to lose a lot of money.
Well, that sounds like being in a band.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, so my expectation is to spend a lot of money that I make it my real job, to just spend it on band stuff.
Yeah.
Just because I want to record the music and release it. And, you know, odds are we'll probably self-release it, or even if we don't, we'll probably foot the bill for a good portion of it.
Yeah.
And that's fine with me, because I think we make good music together, and I just like to get it out there and let people hear it.
Well, what's the dynamic like being behind the drum set and now you're up front singing? Does it come naturally being up front?
No, it doesn't come naturally at all for me to be up front. You know, I've done a lot of shows, like I've done some tours with the solo stuff years ago, but still, like, if I don't play a show for a while and then I play one, it's kind of unnerving to be like the front guy.
Yeah.
A lot of it is because, like, singing, like, I can kind of sing, but I'm not nearly as good at singing and playing guitar as I am on the drums. So I have to, like, think about what I'm doing and try hard. where like drumming, I could pretty much just do it. You know, I can play drums to that kind of music in my sleep.
Yeah.
And I still, when I drum, I'm really into it and I hit hard and I try hard, but I don't have to think at all about what I'm actually doing. But singing and playing guitar, I'm still at the point where I've got to think about what I'm doing and try. So it's, and I've done like the last few months, I've done a handful of acoustic shows, which I had never done before. And that's a whole new level of unnerving.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh yeah. Cause you're completely exposed acoustic wise, as far as even vocal.
Yeah, like
your vocals are, it's exposed the most it can be. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's been like, I think I'm getting better at singing because of doing the acoustic shows.
Yeah.
Because there's nowhere to hide. Like, it's not that bad if you got a full rock band behind you, because you can only like halfway hear what's happening with the singer anyway.
Yeah.
But when it's like you and an acoustic, it's pretty, you're like right there. So anything you mess up, it's blatantly apparent that, yeah, he's off key right there. Or his voice.
Yeah,
it's kind of,
it's like less about the energy and more about the content at that point.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you're, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, because even like, I feel like not just like my guitar playing is exposed, the singing is exposed, but so are the songs.
Oh, yeah.
Like the lyrical content, like your lyrics and your song, your melody and everything is just, it's pretty much naked. So it's a really different experience, but I think it's made me better for doing these shows.
Yeah,
like I'm much more confident now, like going when we do like full rock shows, I feel a lot more confident having done the acoustic shows.
And a lot of the great songwriters, even as far as songwriting, start off with that process, just start off acoustic and voice with the melody, because if the melody and, you know, the guitar lick is good, you're good. Like that should be the basis of the song. As far as lyrics, melody.
I agree.
Yeah.
I always think good lyrics are, I know a lot of people are super into lyrics, but for me, good lyrics are kind of a bonus. Like if a song has this super awesome melody and it's like played well and sung well, I can like a song that has terrible lyrics if it's really, really good.
You're making me think of like the Cars or something. Like I put on the Cars and their choruses are so mind blowing. It like makes your brain hurt. And some of the lyrics are pretty cheesy. Even when you get into like Let's Go, where he's talking about like a teenage girl, it's like, okay, I can kind of forgive the content right here. I don't know.
Yeah, the Cars are a good example. I'm really into a couple albums by Thin Lizzy.
Oh, Thin Lizzy, yeah, like three-part harmonies.
Thin Lizzy, yeah.
Like,
think... it's so good to listen to.
It's so melodic, yeah.
Yeah, the Cowboy song by Thin Lizzy, I think, is one of the best songs of all time. And if you look at the lyrics, like, they're pretty, pretty bad, cheesy lyrics, but it doesn't matter, because he sings them with conviction, and the melody is awesome, and it's got awesome guitar solos, and their drummer is awesome. So it's just, it's a kick-ass song, regardless of the fact that it has like a cheesy storyline to it.
Yeah. Jonah and I had talked about it at some point, you know, lining up some songs that we really like and kind of dissecting the lyrics and, you know, kind of pointing out that sometimes they are just kind of enhancing the melody and the song rather than, you know, anything deep, or, you know, have any content whatsoever.
Yeah. For instance, we were trying to think of like 90s alternative groups. Like, what was the one, like Sponge?
Sponge. Yeah.
Yeah. Where
Bush,
he's like,
any Bush song.
What did he say? What did he's like? He's like, when I wake up from some dream I made up. And it's like, this is such piss poor songwriting. Like,
cool.
Oh yeah, when you listen to melody, like, yeah, as a 14-year-old kid, you're like, this is it.
this is it.
Yeah, what does the line, don't let the days go by, glycerin? What the hell are you talking about?
What are you talking about?
The second album gets even better, but I can't. Yeah, that guy's a millionaire. Go figure.
Good for him.
All right, so we got to wrap up. Is there anything that you want to share with our audience as far as upcoming shows or, like you mentioned, the full length, anything else?
Well, we've got a couple shows. Next weekend, we're on the 22nd, we're playing in Johnsburg, Illinois, which is like way northwest of Chicago, borderline right. Wisconsin. It's the place called Halftime Bar and Grill. And that's a free one. And I've never been to this venue. I don't think they even typically have shows. So it's probably going to be like almost like one of our basement shows where you get like just the vocals through the PA and nothing else.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it'd be kind of like a throwback show.
I like it.
And then we've got the November 29th in Milwaukee at a place called G Daddy's BBC. I've never been there. I think it's a newer place. But that one should be pretty cool. There's a band called Avenues, which is like a pretty good punk band from Milwaukee, our headline in the show.
All right.
So that one should be more of kind of a like a real show, like a proper rock show. But I think I'm excited for both because I like playing the places where there's not even like a real PA and you just have like two speakers
singing
through.
Yeah. I like that too. You hear your amps and it's like band practice almost, you know, it's like, yeah, I don't know. There's more to it.
Yeah. It kind of just shows like, yeah, that's a real band. If you can do that, you don't need anything else. Like to me, that's a real rock band. That's where like we don't really have a punk sound anymore, but all the guys I play with were in punk bands and like, that's how we all grew up playing.
Right.
And I think you can maybe feel that in our music, even though like our songs are pretty slow and you know, we don't sound punk, but I think that part of punk rock we've always kept with us is just like, just
the mentality
especially
of it.
Live, yeah. Just playing, you know?
Yeah. All right.
Cool.
Well,
all right, Mike. Thank you so much.
Yeah. It was great having you on, Mike. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys.
Wow, that was pretty cool. All of you can give us a call at 954-60-SCENE. Please listen to the podcast on iTunes or through our website, mattandjonah.com. Can't wait to see you all next week. Buy a t-shirt and listen. Thanks, Jonah.
Thanks, Matt.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.